there he is in his own words saying that he wants to withdraw the silver certificates. And this executive order was part of that, that whole machination. So the exact opposite of what is being claimed here about Executive Order 11110 going against the bankers is the reality.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you in a conversation that is being recorded on the 16th of May, 2017. And I'm here today to talk to you about something that I continue to receive on a, if not weekly, at least regular basis from various viewers and listeners out there. That is the comment or the question about the JFK myth. Specifically, the idea that JFK was targeted for assassination by the bankers behind the Federal Reserve System because he was on the verge of scrapping the Federal Reserve, overturning it, replacing Federal Reserve notes with U.S. Treasury-issued debt-free precious metal-backed currency. It is a very persistent rumor and something that has signally failed to die, despite the fact that I have addressed it before on the podcast and attempted to wrestle this one down to the ground, but people continue to email me about it from time to time. So let's put it to rest once and for all. And in order to do that, we're going to bring on to the program someone who knows a thing or two about the Federal Reserve System, namely the man who wrote the book on it, the book, the one that everyone knows and reads and cites when it comes to the Federal Reserve, a book that was extremely influential for me in my creation of my Federal Reserve documentary, and a man who himself was one of the sources that was highly featured in that Century of Enslavement documentary. I'm referring to, of course, none other than G. Edward Griffin of Need to Know News at needtoknow.news. You'll have to correct me if I got that URL wrong.
No, you got it fine. Need to know dot news. Yeah,
I was thrown off because dot news is still not a very common URL. But at any rate, it is need to know dot news, and it will, of course, be linked in the show notes. G. Edward Griffin, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, thank you, James. It's a pleasure to be on your show, as usual. I have watched you grow in your wisdom and your knowledge and your audience base over the years. And you have truly a very impressive operation going there. So it's my honor to be part of this. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for that. Coming from you, that does mean an awful lot to me. So let's get into the subject of today's conversation, which, as I say, is about this JFK myth, or as you call it in The Creature from Jekyll Island. You have a section on the JFK rumor, which you dispelled at that time, decades ago, when you first wrote that book. But let's examine this in some more detail, because I think we really need to address some of the specifics that are raised in this rumor so that we can understand that the truth is, in fact, the exact opposite of what these people are claiming. So, probably a source that most people are wittingly or not getting this rumor from is Jim Marr's book Crossfire on the JFK assassination. And I want to preface this by saying that I think this is still a very valuable tome for researchers into the JFK assassination. There's a lot of very important information that Jim Marr was able to uncover, a lot of legwork and investigative journalism that went into the creation of this, lots of very important, valuable information that stands. Unfortunately, some information that doesn't stand, and I think this is one example of that, which was really only mentioned in passing on a page or two here, but I think is probably the source of a lot of people coming to understand this. So let's just read a little bit about the argument itself. Jim Marr writes, "Another overlooked aspect of Kennedy's attempt to reform American society involves money. Kennedy apparently reasoned that by returning to the Constitution, which states that only Congress shall coin and regulate money, the soaring national debt could be reduced by not paying interest to the makers of the Federal Reserve System, who print paper money, then loan it to the government at interest. He moved in this area on June 4, 1963, by signing Executive Order 11110, which called for the issuance of $4,292,893,815 in United States notes through the U.S. Treasury rather than the traditional Federal Reserve System. That same day, Kennedy signed a bill changing the backing of $1 and $2 bills from silver to gold, adding strength to the weakened U.S. currency. Kennedy's controller of the currency, James J. Saxon, had been at odds with the powerful Federal Reserve Board for some time, encouraging broader investment and lending powers for banks that were not part of the Federal Reserve System. Saxon also had decided that non-reserve banks could underwrite state and local general obligation bonds, again weakening the dominant Federal Reserve banks. A number of Kennedy bills were indeed issued. The author has a $5 bill in his possession with the heading United States Notes, but were quickly withdrawn after Kennedy's death. According to information from the Library of the Comptroller of the Currency, Executive Order 11110 remains in effect today, which would have been 1988, as Mars was writing this, although successive administrations, beginning with that of President Lyndon Johnson, apparently have simply ignored it, and instead returned to the practice of paying interest on Federal Reserve notes. Today, we continue to use Federal Reserve notes, and the deficit is at an all-time high. All right, so that's just a sampling from Crossfire, where a lot of this this rumor originates. G. Edward Griffin, it's a very persuasive case that's being laid out here, even very specific figures about exactly how many notes, the dollar value of the notes that were issued and all of this, and he has in his possession a $5 U.S. note that was issued under Kennedy in 1963. It sounds like a very persuasive case. What is wrong about it?
Well, yes, you're quite right. It sounds very persuasive, and we know that the banking cartel is certainly not what we would call the white hats out there. So there's a tendency for us cynics, if not skeptics, to say, yeah, they probably did that, you know, because it's the kind of thing would not surprise us. But as it turns out, that very few of those facts can be confirmed. Because when I was doing the research for my book, naturally that was one of the issues that I wanted to touch upon. And frankly, the way I came across the information was presented in such a way that I was assuming that it was correct. And but with everything, I try to run it down and just make sure that it is. And especially if something is controversial, I think those of us who are going upstream, we have the handicap of having to prove everything we say. Now, if we were saying what everybody believed to be true, even though it was false, we wouldn't have to prove anything because everybody knows it's true. So you don't have to document or footnote everything, but we have the handicap of being upstreamers. So if we don't document everything we say and go to original sources, we can be dismissed quite easily. So that was a kind of a discipline I've had to accept from the very beginning when I started down this path. And I'm glad it was that way because it allowed me to discover things like this that weren't quite true. And it made me realize that we're all very, very vulnerable to accepting things on the basis of our belief systems. And so that's just a prefatory comment to the fact that when I started to look into this matter, James, I found out that most of the issues that you described there were semi-truths. They contained some elements of truth in them, but the hardcore basement floor of truth was not there. So, for example, what am I talking about? It is true that the executive order 11110 was signed by President Kennedy, but all the narratives that have been given on this say something to the effect that this executive order ordered the Treasury Department to issue these notes. And the fact of the matter is it didn't do anything of the kind. I ran down the executive order, got a copy of it. Anybody could do this, can do it today on the internet. It doesn't do anything of the kind. All it does is amend a previous executive order that's been longstanding, and it authorizes, doesn't order, it authorizes the Treasury Secretary to do a job that the president used to do. That's all it does. It's a very simple thing. It, up until that executive order, only the president of the United States could demand or issue he had the authority to issue these Treasury notes. And so what President Kennedy was doing was actually giving up authority to issue these notes and giving it to the Treasury Secretary as more of a housekeeping operation. It had to be done anyway, and there was too much coming across the president's desk. Why not just authorize the Secretary of the Treasury to do so? He was not ordered to do so. He was authorized to do so in case the need should ever arise. Well, it did arise a little bit later on, as everyone knows, because some of those notes were produced and wound up in circulation, but they were not in large quantities. They were meant to replace worn-out notes that had been ruined or disappeared from circulation. The laws, monetary laws, require that a certain level of these notes be kept in circulation, and so when the number is detected to be insufficient, then the law requires the issuance of new ones to replace them, and that's been going on for a long, long time. Nothing new in any of that. And this executive order simply authorized the Secretary of the Treasury to do it instead of the President. Well, as it turns out, the Secretary of the Treasury at that time, as I remember, was Dylan Reed, was part of the banking fraternity. So here was President Kennedy giving the power to issue these notes to the banking fraternity, really. It was actually giving the banks more power than they had in the beginning. And this is a fact that nobody ever digs into. And, well, it goes on and on. There's a lot of things that happened in that thing. I don't want to bore your listeners with the details. But everywhere I looked, I found out that the details of what actually happened was just the reverse, as you say. It actually gave the power, more power to the banks to control this monetary system than they had before. The narrative usually is that that power is still in existence today. Well, it's not. And it's easy to find out that that executive order, or at least the one behind it, which is the foundation, was actually rescinded by President Reagan. It's no longer on the books, contrary to what you just read. And you can just go on and on, and everything sort of disappears as you pursue it. You find out that it is, in fact, a myth. And then you take a look at President Kennedy's record, too. It's certainly an illogical myth, because regardless of what we may think about President Kennedy, and he certainly did a lot of wonderful things, and he's certainly given some good speeches. We understand that, talking about exposing conspiracies and so forth. But the fact of the matter is the man was a graduate of the London School of Economics, which is, everyone who studied these things know, that's the bedrock of international socialism. That is where the Fabian socialists got their foothold. And everybody that goes through that educational mill comes out the other side as a globalist, an internationalist, a friend of international banking, and Kennedy was also. I mean, I'm sorry to say it, folks, but Mr. Kennedy was a globalist. And if you look at his voting record and his stance in international affairs, he was really a friend of the international community more than what we would call the hardcore America First type of person. And so the idea that he would be turning against the banks is just illogical. And in fact, that is not what happened. Now, part of this mystique is the statement we run across a lot about a speech that President Kennedy is said to have made at Columbia University. This, I think, was about 10 days before his assassination. And the quotation is, as I recall, that President Kennedy said, "I must warn the American people that the presidency of the United States has been used to great harm, and I must warn the American people about what is really going on." And then 10 days later, he was assassinated. Well, it's a cryptic message. We don't really know what that means, but it sounds like he's going to spill the beans on something very big. And possibly that's the reason they had to kill him. Well, I thought that was an interesting statement, and I wanted to know more about it. So I contacted the Columbia University, and I asked if I could have a transcript of the whole speech. Well, I found out, they called me back a few days later, said, well, President Kennedy did not speak at Columbia University on that date, nor did he ever speak at the Columbia University on any other date. Well, isn't that interesting? Well, possibly they got the university wrong. Maybe he spoke at some other university. So I contacted the White House, and I said, is there a record of President Kennedy's activities on this date? And they said, well, we'll get back in touch with you. And they dug into the archives and sent me a copy of his calendar and all of that. And on that particular day, he was in the White House, had some appointment with ambassadors. And everywhere you look, you find that the story that was so intriguing and so fascinating, we thought, aha, this really proves what we know is true, it just doesn't hold up. Now, that does not mean that Kennedy was onto something and was not onto something. It does not mean that he never said that. All it means is that the way the story was presented to us cannot be documented. And I think we have to be very careful before we start repeating these things to make sure that what we're talking about can be supported and backed up. Otherwise, we discredit ourselves, and everything we know about the evils of the Federal Reserve System goes up in smoke because they, you guys make things up as you go.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's a part of intellectual integrity that if we are not careful, and if we follow the rabbit down the wrong rabbit hole for spurious reasons, then we risk putting the entire endeavor in jeopardy because we're not careful about the information that we're taking on board. To follow up on some of the things that you mentioned there, yes, the JFK mystique and the myth seems to permeate everything surrounding JFK, so that anything will fit into this narrative that he was some sort of godly figure from on high that was sent to, you know, shepherd America into a great era, and he was stolen from us, which, I mean, I understand why that mystique is there, but it permeates everything, including even that secret society conspiracy speech, which is often cited, but often only a few minutes, segments of that much larger speech, and only certain pieces of that speech are generally put together into what sounds like a continuous 3 or 4 minute speech, but is in fact little bits and pieces. If you go and listen to the full speech, it is not only clear that he was talking about the Soviet conspiracy, but in fact that the warning that he was giving to journalists in that speech was a warning that we have a free and open society, so you guys better learn to shut up when you need to shut up, because we don't want to have to crack down on you. It is really remarkable when you look at the speech in its entirety, which I did back in Questions for Corbett number 18, so people can check the archives for that. Just to add a little bit more meat to the bones of what you're discussing there, yes, we won't bore people with all of the individual details, but we will put a link into an article that you wrote several years ago, putting all of this in perspective, that was on your Freedom Force International site, in which you talk about Executive Order 10289, which was the underlying order that was first issued in 1951, that this order amended to basically, yes, transfer the right of the president, the authority the president had to issue those notes, to the Treasury Secretary, who, as you say, was part of the banking complex. So it was, if anything, an attempt to get rid of that power, or at least put it into the banking oligarch's hands. And as you say, the issuance that did take place in 1963 was part of a congressionally mandated issuance in compliance with an 1868 Act of Congress, which directed the Treasury to maintain the amount of U.S. notes outstanding at a fixed level. So it had to be done in 1963. Yeah. What Kennedy did was essentially transfer the power to the Treasury Secretary to ultimately start the process of stopping that regular issuance, exactly. Which in fact is exactly what occurred. That issuance never occurred again after 1963.
So there you have it. The whole essence of this executive order, if you want to really follow it to its core, was to remove silver from the monetary system.
Yes, and it gets even more explicit than that, because I will read from the economic report of the president, i.e. President Kennedy's economic report of January 1963, where he wrote, quote, "I again urge a revision in our silver policy to reflect the status of silver as a metal for which there is an expanding industrial demand. Except for its use in coins, silver serves no useful monetary function. In 1961, at my direction, sales of silver were suspended by the Secretary of the Treasury. As further steps, I recommend repeal of those acts that oblige the Treasury to support the price of silver, and repeal of the special 50% tax on transfers of interest in silver, and authorization for the Federal Reserve System to issue notes in denominations of $1, so as to make possible the gradual withdrawal of silver certificates from circulation and the use of the silver thus released for coinage purposes. I urge the Congress to take prompt action on these recommended changes." There he is in his own words saying that he wants to withdraw the silver certificates, and this executive order was part of that whole machination. So the exact opposite of what is being claimed here about Executive Order 11110 going against the bankers is
the James, I know that you know this. Whenever you take a stance like this and you blow away one of these myths, you're going to come under attack from people who will say, "Who are you on the other side? Are you a traitor? Are you you know, have you gone on the side of the banks or whatever?" Because you're not supporting the myth. I was amazed that when I published that article that you were referring to years ago, I was inundated with people. I thought they were going to come and lynch me because they thought I was attacking Kennedy, you know, and they thought I had gone over to the dark side because I was simply quoting the truth. It's amazing how human nature works that way.
It is. And as you say, the people's perceptions, people's ideas can sometimes override any sort of rational basis for those beliefs. And again, in Creature from Jekyll Island, you do talk about, for example, citing Kennedy's close relationship to the international banking community, you write, one of the early American advocates of socialism on a global scale, including the draining of wealth away from the rich United States, quote unquote, was John F. Kennedy. He undoubtedly learned the concept while attending the Fabian London School of Economics in 1935-36, just prior to his father's appointment as ambassador to England. When JFK became president, his political views continued to carry the imprint of that training. In September of 1963, he addressed the finance ministers and central bank governors from 102 nations at the annual meeting of the IMF World Bank. He explained the concept of world socialism in glowing terms. 20 years ago, when the architects of these institutions met to design an international banking structure, the economic life of the world was polarized in overwhelming and even alarming measure on the United States. 60% of the gold reserves of the world were here in the United States. There was a need for redistribution of the financial resources of the world, and there was an equal need to organize a flow of capital to the impoverished countries of the world. All this has come about. It did not come about by chance, but by conscious and deliberate and responsible planning. Oh yes, central planning, that's the ticket.
And James, don't forget to say you were quoting President Kennedy.
Yes, read that. Yes, sorry, I should make that clear. That was a quote from President Kennedy at the IMF World Bank. So again, the idea that he was against the bankers is exactly opposed to what we know is documentable and on the record, and we will of course include links to everything that we've just talked about here. But I think this raises a larger epistemological point, if you'll excuse my philosophizing, which is the idea that sometimes an argument can be persuasive precisely because we do not know what we do not know about a topic. For example, again, if you're just listening to someone characterizing Executive Order 11110 and talking, putting the JFK assassination into that context, again, as you say, it makes sense. People, I'm sure, who are listening to this conversation might be even inclined to believe an argument even before hearing the details because it fits in with the worldview. Yeah, okay, the bankers were probably behind it. And what do you think this tells us about the way people operate and the types of pitfalls that we often fall into when we are confronting subjects which we don't know everything about?
Well, I think what it really tells us is that we have to be very, very cautious and very suspicious of our own belief systems. We have to be willing to challenge and question and re-examine, because none of us, I think none of us are immune to that. But the more we are aware of that possibility and the more we get caught a couple of times along the way and remember how embarrassing and humiliating it is to realize that, oh my gosh, I was really on the wrong side of that one. And the more we have to eat crow and the more we realize that, okay, we made a mistake, I'm not going to make that mistake again, why, you come to sort of a humility point. And so I don't mean to come across as being critical or being condemning other people for falling into the trap, because we've all done that and we're probably going to continue to do that. So what it tells me is that we are human. And it tells me we better be jolly well aware of it as we go along and be cautious and to question authority. I don't care whose authority. We have our own authorities, right? I mean, I consider you to be an authority. You consider me to be an authority on the Federal Reserve. Okay, that's great. I appreciate that. Thank you. But question that authority, because, you know, I'll guarantee you that I've made mistakes and I just don't know which ones they are. And nobody does, but probably somebody will point it out to me. I remember when I wrote the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, I put in the very front part, the introduction, that, you know, this is a huge journey and nobody can walk such a long path without stumbling a couple of times. And so I asked people to please be kind, but to be very careful to tell me if they find something in this book that's wrong. I want to know. I want to correct it. And I'm happy to say that I didn't get too many of those that came in. A lot of them found typographical errors, of course, but only a couple of factual errors. But I was delighted to get those critiques so I could change it and set the record straight. So I haven't had any of those in quite a few years now. But I'm telling you that everybody makes these mistakes because we assume that information is correct because it comes from the right source. But we have to question authority all the way.
Such an important point to make. And yes, this applies to everyone, including myself, including yourself, including every single person listening to this conversation. We will all get caught up in this at some point. It's important to understand and acknowledge that blind spots exist and that we will all make mistakes. And the best we can do is continually check and recheck our assumptions against the actual facts as we can best determine them. It's not a 100% spotless, flawless process. It's not going to be unerringly just going towards the truth at all times. We will stumble. But the point is, we have to at least be willing to question ourselves and our beliefs and our assumptions at all times. And it's a difficult process because it's so easy to fall into comfortable habits of thinking. But you're probably not listening to this conversation if you're one of those people who prefer the comfortable habits of thinking rather than challenging your beliefs. I'm sure you fell down a rabbit hole or other somewhere along the way if you've ended up here. So welcome, and I'm glad to have you aboard, and we're all in this together. We all have to continue checking our assumptions on even things like the JFK myth. Now, this might be a good opportunity to talk about an opportunity for people out there to check their assumptions and question their reality. I'm referring to the Red Pill Expo that's coming up in Bozeman, Montana, at which, of course, you will be delivering a keynote address, and there will be many other speakers there. Tell us about the Red Pill Expo.
Well, yes, my favorite topic of late, of course. We're sponsoring the Red Pill Expo in Bozeman, Montana, of all unlikely places. It's a wonderful place for an event like this. I'll come back to that perhaps. June 22nd and 23rd and 24th of this year. And of course, I'm sure all of your viewers, James, understand, take the red pill. They know what that means. But just in case there's somebody that just dropped off the Christmas tree, it all goes back to a sci-fi movie called The Matrix. I guess it's about 20 years old now. And the theme of the story is that all humans are living in this matrix, this illusion that nothing is real, but they don't know that. They think they're leading normal lives. They think they're going to work. They think they're going to church and so forth and voting and all these things. But none of it's actually real. And somebody breaks out of this matrix, and he's trying to rescue everybody else, all of his human compatriots. Hey, wake up, everybody. Get out of the matrix. And in the story, the way you do that is you take a red pill. And once you take the pill, the red pill, not the blue pill puts you right back into the illusion. Once you take the red pill, now you really see how things are. Not everybody likes to see the way things really are, and so they take the blue pill. So that's what it's all about, and I think it's a wonderful allegory because life in our reality is really like that. I find myself, every day I discover, oh my gosh, that was another red pill I just swallowed. I thought, but that's not the way it is. I mean, what could I say? I thought that the medical profession was here to cure diseases. Well, not necessarily. We find that the pharmaceutical industry isn't interested in curing diseases, but in treating diseases, in keeping them there for a cash revenue because you need treatment. Cures don't make any money. Oh my gosh, was that a red pill? You know. And then I used to think that the government was there to help us. You talk about a big red pill. They're not there to help us. They're there to exploit us in most cases, not in every case. And you just go down the line everywhere you look, you find out I was really misled. So everybody, or a lot of people, have taken the red pill on this, that, or the other thing. And I got this idea last year. Wouldn't it be a great idea if we could just bring all of these red pill takers together and we could swap stories and say, well, let me tell you about what I learned that turned out to be different from what I thought. And that's actually happening. Let's cut to the chase. We're having people coming to this event from literally around the world. We've got some great well-known speakers there. Perhaps one of the best known is Robert Kiyosaki, very popular writer. He's probably, his books have probably outsold any other financial advice books. Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I don't know, millions and millions and millions of copies. He could hardly wait to get there because this is his kind of a group. Of course, I'll be speaking there, and we've got, come to the website, and the way to get to that site and see what it's all about and see these fantastic speakers that are there is just go to redpillexpo.net, redpillexpo.net, and you see all the speakers and all the events, and it's Bozeman or bust, I'll tell you that. We're going to be there. So that's it.
And I will be speaking there as well, for those who are unfamiliar with this.
Will.
Yes, I will be there by Skype, so I will not be in person, but I will be presenting via Skype. And it's funny. It is really funny to me that you contact me out of the blue about this Red Pill Expo you were organizing to ask me to speak at the event. And I have been kicking around with this essay, which is part of a larger book project that I've been working on for almost a decade now. But the essay specifically was about the idea of the monetary system, the Federal Reserve monetary system, and the idea of the matrix. It relies on a matrix metaphor. And then to get this message from G. Edward Griffin, would you like to present? I have the space for you to present. And it just came together so perfectly. I thought, wow, this is almost divine providence of some sort.
Well, I can hardly wait to hear what you have to say on that, James. And anyway, it's going to be a grand occasion. And I have to say that we're not going to this event. We're not creating this event just to go hear a lot of people tell us about things we didn't know about or to scare the britches off of us. You know, that's not what it's all about. What we really want to do is bring people together face to face from all different cross sections, people with different ideas, different solutions to our problems, different cultures, different styles, you know. Everybody said, let's get together. Let's all form one group. No, that's not it. I think diversity is strength. But there is a commonality to all of that. And I believe when we get there, we're going to find out that the commonality is that we're being coerced. We're being coerced by the system to do things that are not good for us, things that we don't want to do, and we're being told it's for our own good. That is the commonality across the board. And once I think people get the understanding that it's this thing called collectivism and that the solution is another thing called individualism, then all of a sudden we have created unity, and yet we're still allowing the diversity to exist and to flourish. That's what I hope to see, a real coalition come out of this.
Yes. Well, the straw man argument, of course, is that, individualism, that means you don't want community, you don't want to get together. No, that is not what that means. It just means that we do not sacrifice our individual self for some collective good or nebulously defined collective good that, of course, is always defined by the ruling oligarchy rather than...
Yeah, they say, I represent the people.
Yes.
Yeah, we are the party, the vanguard, the people's party, so forth. And that's the door through which all of the tyranny comes, in the name of the people.
Always and forever, it will wrap itself in whatever flag is convenient in order to get the message across. So there is only one way around that, and that is the opposite direction, towards individualism, towards decentralization, towards cooperating with each other voluntarily. Can you imagine such a concept? Well, I'm looking forward to delivering that presentation because I do hope it will help people to in a more explicit way, in a more crystal clear way, take a definitive stance towards getting out of that matrix. So I do think it's a message of empowerment.
Yes, I think so. So I hope your listeners have come to redpillexpo.net, look it up, sign up, and we'll see you in Bozeman.
Absolutely. All right, we're going to leave this conversation for today, but as I say, there's lots and lots of meat in the show notes for this conversation, so please do go and look through them. There's lots of information. If you want to know more about EO 11110 and the FedMyth, or the Red Pill Expo, all of the links and information will be there. And of course, you can always get G. Edward Griffin's website at needtoknow.news. Again, the link will be in the show notes. G. Edward Griffin, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, James. Thank you very much.
The Federal Reserve. the heart of the American banking system. For over 100 years, it has operated in the shadows, controlling America's money supply in total secrecy.
So all that information is available in our commercial paper program.
And who got the money?
Hundreds and hundreds of banks, any bank or that has access to the U.S. Federal Reserve's discount.
Can you tell us who they are?
No.
Until now.
100 years ago, in 1913, the Fed was created.
Fractional reserve banking.
The legal authority to do it.
Takeover of monetary policy.
Are conducted by the Federal Reserve banks. They are banks.
There is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take.
Century of Enslavement, the history of the Federal Reserve. Watch the documentary for free at corbettreport.com/Federal Reserve and purchase a copy on DVD to help support the Corbett Report today.